Continuing review of communications. This is tape number 8 of the review of communications for the United States Coast Guard cutter Itasca for June and July 1937. We are continuing with our interview with Lieutenant Commander Anthony, who at that time was a warrant officer and the assistant chief of staff, I guess, and communications officer at least, at the Hawaiian section in Honolulu. And we'll pick up where we left off, interview with Anthony.
3105 towards the last, and she says, I'm going to switch to 6210. Wait, listen on 6210. Oh, stay where you are, because they aren't set up on 6210.
They could receive it.
Yeah, but they could never have answered
have to, no, he'd have to recalibrate.
And they've got that on 7500. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I'll show you in the logbook, not, I don't think you'll find it in this log at all. What log would it be in? It'd be in O'Hara's log. Remember Tom O'Hara, by any chance?
No.
He was just a third class. Anyway, in his log, Bell Arts came in just about 2 minutes before her last message and took the T-60 and recalibrated it to 12-6 because they figured she was down. And,
yeah, right,
and so now they weren't set up transmit at all on 6210 or 30 or 7500. All they had left was 3105, and she announced she was going to leave 3105. Yeah. And of course they just start screaming at her, you know, don't do it. Anyway, make a long story short, that was the last message, as you know, they ever heard from her. By the way, TT is Tom O'Hare's call sign. Tom O'Hare, that no signal 3105 and impossible to work it. AR. 04. Then she never answered.
See, she couldn't kind of receive it. He didn't go to 7500.
Well, she heard him. And
she didn't hear him on 7500.
Well, she said she did.
Yeah, well, she might. She certainly didn't get it.
Well, she said she rotated her loop and couldn't get a minimum.
That's a lot of BS. Because that DF never went to 7500 unless they put a new one on in Miami and I never heard of it. That DF of hers would not go to 7500. How many DFs in those days on High Creek?
Very few. They'd have to be specially designed.
No, certainly. I don't think she had it the plane before at Leak Field that long ago. She had that standard DF. And I know she never got a new DF in Miami. I'd be willing to bet on that.
She did.
She didn't know what the hell she heard. She was so damn frustrated. And she overshot, just like when she went across the Atlantic, when Newland said, shift out, you're going north too far, and she wanted to land at St. Louis, and she told him to go to hell. Or where's that effect?
Well, now, when the Shoshone, when they were westbound, there was that message we talked about earlier that said that she was, the plane requested that they could put a direction finder on Howland Island. Now, Black evidently picked that up, and then when he was named to be her representative, whatever that meant. And so he was in on that message earlier, and now that she's eastbound, he evidently contacted someone.
We got a DF from the Navy. We arranged to get one from the Navy. A little portable DF.
But did he come to you to see if there's anything we could find that we could put
on? Yeah, we asked us if we had anything. Right. We had nothing like that. We used to have the old suitcase DF, so we used chasing rummage, but hell, you could only go up to about, 3,000, something like that.
So 3105, 6210 was out of the question.
So the Navy had one, and they got one from the Navy.
Did you know anything about it? Did you go to the Navy?
Oh, I saw the damn thing, but I remember when they got it on board, the Itasca, I've even forgotten what type it is.
Could you describe it at all?
Just a small job, small loop, battery operated. What that is. I don't remember the type.
Was the loop physically mounted right on top of the receiving unit?
Just like I was, something like our suitcase model, but it was a little bulky. Not a suitcase, handles to pick it up. I can't remember the name. His name's radio man at the end of that now.
Was he trained by them how to use it at all? Or
I don't think he'd ever use one. He'd use the ship's DF. What the hell's the difference? You use a DF, a DF makes no difference. What frequency, you know what you're looking for. He picked her up on that deal.
I'll refresh your memory. His name was Cipriani.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Frank Cipriani. Yeah, yeah. You remember him at all?
Well,
he was on the Taney, actually.
Well, yeah, we've sent some extra people from the Taney to the...
He was a second-class RM, and he was detached from the Taney and sent over to the... what I'm wondering about was he was given any information on the direction finder before he ever...
Sure, they might have on the way down. I don't know. But what the hell, a DF is a DF.
Just a receiver, nothing very complicated.
All you do is look for your minimum and null, and that's it.
There is a problem that comes up, however, with he never got a bearing on her, even though she was loud and clear for a couple of hours.
He said she wasn't on long enough to get a bearing on her. But hell, if you're working, I've taken 1,001 DF bearing, medium frequency and high frequency, and I'll get a minimum, and at least you get an idea of the direction. She was up northwest of Howland.
You keep refining it down. Well, there was a problem. We can go into that if you'd like to. It says here, NRUI2, the portable, giving dope that no SIGs on 3105. He just didn't get them. And impossible to work AR. Now, I have his logs. However, his logs are extremely suspect.
You mean while he was on the island?
Yeah. The logs are suspect because... Did you know Bill Sutter? You ever served with him later? By the way, he's healthy, wealthy, and wise. Puffy Sutter, right. He's working as a training officer for the Maritime School in Union in New York. And running their school there. I'm looking for the logs on shore now, just a second. He was supposed to be keeping logs on Howland Island.
Yeah. He was probably doing. He was dealing with the fence line, and he didn't have a mill over there.
I suppose.
I don't think so.
Did you ever hear where he set up, set the direction finder up?
Oh Christ! It was near the runway.
Must have been inside of a tent or something.
Yeah, they had some. Because see, they had quarters there for those colonists.
But he wouldn't want to set up
outside of it, yeah.
A tent would have been all right, probably, especially
the
side of the
house. Set up. They had tents there. I don't remember what kind.
Yeah, there was a bunch of tents left over from the guys that were working on WPA workers. Well, his problem was that he was sent ashore the night before, and he started watch when they knew that she was considered to be in range, and he started watch at 10 o'clock that night. And he stood watch all night long, according to his log. He stood watch all night long. About, according to his log, now, about 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, or after her first couple good transmissions, and he hadn't got a bearing, he said said something to the effect that a signal was overmodulated or something. It really didn't mean anything because he should have been on CW by the time he's trying to pick up bearing anyway. He's going to put a deep frequency oscillator. Anyway, finally he said, conserving batteries as much as possible because I'm nearly dead. And towards the end, he said he didn't hear anything. And he said, all batteries on island completely dead. And of course, now she's starting to get close to island, wants a bearing, please. The batteries all there because he didn't have training. He didn't know that his batteries were good for about 8 hours, and he ran them dead. By the time the DF was necessary, there wasn't anything left. Did you ever hear anything about this?
Yeah. He got a cut on her, and I talked to him after they got back down. He got a cut on her, but it wasn't a good cut because she was only on 8 seconds, and he got a direction that was northwest. Well, of course, it could have been the opposite, but there was definitely she overshot and was heading back. And,
For such a lousy cut, he was afraid to tell anybody about it?
didn't think was accurate. Well, see, when that ship returned to Honolulu, I interviewed everybody on there, you know, from the old man on down. And all of them, of course, a lot of the notes I have, I never kept anymore. But, Thompson, next to Morgenthau, the Secretary of Treasury, came out in Honolulu, you know. And Thompson was supposed, this has nothing to do with that, but Thompson was supposed to be at the dock when the mats only were literally, whichever the hell it was, came in. I had to hold up old man Thompson as the guy there doing that morning. There's nothing to do with it. Thompson was a very fine officer. I knew him. I never served under him. Of course, Frankie Kenner was down there, too.
Yeah.
So, you may have heard of it, may not, but I've been known as the person that knows more about a major air hostage flight than anybody else in the world.
No wonder I kept running across your name every time I turned around.
I've given 101 talks on the last flight. Of course, I don't buy this shit that's been publicized, but
probably the Saipan stuff and all that.
Yes. All of it. All of it is left-handed. There's no... How do they know? As I directed that search for the first 5 days until the Navy took over.
Why don't you think she heard them on 3105?
I don't believe she did.
But why not?
I don't know. Who knows? She never heard them on 7500 because she couldn't get up there. Why didn't she hear them on 500? The way they were transmitting steadily. She never heard them once on 500. At least she never admitted. And how many times did she answer the Itasca?
Only the one
time. That's right. Knowing the Major Earhart and Vaughn Noonan back aft.
He admitted then that he just was afraid to give that bearing because it was such
sure,
a bad
one. I know. That was my interpretation.
Now, he stayed on the island, as you know, during the rest of the search.
Oh, yeah.
And, see, these logs... I tell you, Leo told me some things that, like I said, I have no secret. But they made some mistakes. And what the hell? You're not going to hang yourself. In fact, it's against our Constitution to testify against yourself. It's not even considered good
manners. Some of the stuff that I say, I talk to all some of the stuff I wouldn't even put in writing.
And Leo admitted that they made some mistakes. And O'Hare also admitted that the 3105 transmitter wasn't modulated. They were just putting out a carrier.
Yeah, because you could barely get up there. You could barely sneak that 3105.
And that upset the modulator unit.
Yeah.
But it wasn't.
And, she should have heard the damn thing as close as she was.
I'm going to stop that right there for a minute, make a couple, three comments. We'll pick it right up. One thing is, Mr. Anthony didn't know that the RA-1 receiver had been put on. We have the bands of the RA-1. It does cover 7,500. In fact, it goes up to 10,000 kilohertz, 10 megacycles, megahertz. And also, the fact that he didn't seem surprised that the T-10 wasn't modulating. I'll go back and I'm going to rewind that just a little bit and play that over again because, of course, it is very, very significant. I'll just pick it up and we'll hit it again.
They were just putting out a carrier.
Yeah, because you could barely get up there. You could barely sneak that 3105.
And that upset the modulator unit.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
But she should have heard the damn thing as close as she was.
Now, they said they couldn't figure it out, and the damn transmitters, the mills were here, and the clock and the receivers right up in the front here. The damn transmitter was way over here, and they couldn't see the dials on it. And when they, they had to switch to voice, and they were using the microphone and that, but they couldn't see the plate grids and stuff. When we modulated, because it was too far over. But when they couldn't, it was obvious they weren't here, and they got checking. Christ, they weren't modulated. So Leo kicked the damn thing, and then it started modulating. And so immediately he got on and asked, I can't remember who it was, how do you hear me? And they came back loud and clear. Boy, he made sure he got that in the logbook. Did Leo ever?
Yeah.
He told you about it, no?
Then you had enough officers in that goddamn radio room at that time to shake a stick at.
Steve Thompson's dead.
Yeah.
And I'd like to find out if those logs were made up later just to cover everybody before they got back in the room.
Mm-hmm. And I doubt that. He could have heard that Itasca, he could have been off frequency with his DF.
Or he was providing the mic.
He could have heard the Itasca, but he could have been a little bit off frequency. If she wasn't right on, I say again that you had to, you barely could make 3105 on that transmitter. And he could hear that DF. That wasn't, as I remember, what you'd call finely calibrated. And if that ship was putting out, we're not sure it was. But he Ten had a good broad signal.
Do you think it was modulating on 31?
Oh, sure, there's no question.
Do you think it was?
I've never seen one that didn't. Not unless you had a complete breakdown.
Unless they got excited and forgot to switch to.
Well, that can happen. Yeah, that can happen after all with human error.
Or instead meant to switch to A3, then switch to MCW instead, and we're just putting out a steady tone. Of course, it seems like if they were doing that, she would have heard the MCW and said something to the effect, all I get out of you is a steady tone. But she didn't say anything.
No, I didn't either.
I want to show you some pictures, and you've seen these pictures, I'm sure. I believe I know where that picture is taken, and I'd just like you to...
Well, that's a Chris Holmes place, I would say. Yeah, that back there. That wasn't where we were sitting.
He's looking at the picture of Amelia dressed in a Japanese kimono with the two Japanese girls serving her tea on a little table. He immediately recognizes it as Chris Holmes' place.
That looks like some Chris Holmes... I ruined this picture with a flash. I was taking it, but ignoring that, you can see out the window. That looked more like the... That's the Chris Holmes' place in Honolulu, then.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
That's a lot of years back to remember stuff like that.
He had Japanese servants like that then. He didn't have Chinese servants, he had Japanese servants.
Might have been. I didn't see all of them. One of their trucks. I don't care. I mean, how do you remember things like that?
But right off, you saw these pictures, you were pretty sure that was Chris Holmes.
Definitely.
Okay. That's where I thought they were taken. These were taken in January 35, by the way. They weren't taken in March of 37.
Yeah.
She was over there earlier on another flight with Nancy.
Yeah, because she flew originally from, I don't know, the Oakland.
Yeah, and she was the first one to ever do that.
She'd have lived, she'd have been the first woman astronaut.
But what?
If she'd have lived, she'd have been the first woman astronaut. She had the guts.
She
didn't lack courage, but she was a fathead. She was a bitch in my book.
You spent a couple hours with her. What was your? Why did you say that? Because usually she got along pretty well with people.
She wouldn't tell you what the hell she wanted. Or what she had. And I've always said, and I've said it 100 times in my talk, she could arrive. She had the sex appeal of a used paper napkin. She could have arrived on Devil's Island as a virgin and left 6 months later in the same category. Always gets a rise out of the audience. Yeah. Anything like that. No, she was just a fathead. Publicity stunt, that's all it was. regrettable that she was lost, but it's her own fault.
When the accident occurred there on Loop Island, Noonan and Manning were in the back.
Manning was on board, but Paul Vance offloaded.
Now, when they got out of the airplane, were you around?
I didn't talk to him. I didn't, the office was a lot of...
Because evidently Manning had enough.
Manning was... I don't know what Manning ever went on that deal for to start off. Anyhow. But they were shook up, obviously, you know, when he comes around. But she was loaded. Full loaded. I've heard, and I've never been able to prove, but as long as she was in the air, she could drive the aircraft. But she wasn't too good on takeoff and landing. If she'd ever made Howland Island on that first westbound trip, she would have creamed on the takeoff. She might have brought that thing down on that runway because she was light. But I'd like to have seen her take off on loaded.
Rio had to repair the thing. The loop was on top of it, and it did not have slip rings. It just had wire. And Cipriani, somewhere along the line, had turned the thing too damn far, and he pulled all the wires off the loop.
They got it fixed up.
Yeah, they repaired it. You know, he was used to slip rings. He wasn't used to not being able to turn it, or they had stops. This thing was kind of a experimental thing. Didn't have stops, didn't have slip rings, and he got excited sometimes. He forgot which way he was turning. He turned it too far and pulled it all off. But that was just a matter of soldering it all up again.
I don't remember where, whatever happened to it. It wouldn't have turned back to me.
I can't remember any of the personnel over there that I had run down.
That was the end of the interview done on July 22nd, 1975 with Commander Anthony. We did a later interview in 1977. That tape is not available right now. I'll review it later when it is available. If there's anything significant, I'll put it on later in the review of communications. Basically, as I remember, this tape pretty much had all of whatever Mr. Anthony had to say. In recapping it, the only thing significant, I believe, that he had to say was that the Navy direction finder probably was returned to the Navy after it was returned from Howland Island, that the T-10 was just barely able to make 3105, but he thought that the idea that it wasn't modulating wasn't a very good idea. He did not believe that the Hawaiian boys stood watches on the Howland direction finder. He believes that Cipriani probably did it all. He did seem to know about the wires being broken on the loop of the direction finder and that they had been repaired before they were returned. And other than that, he didn't really seem to have an awful lot of information either in his paperwork or in his memory about much factual information about what happened. Okay, so that completes the Anthony interview, and we'll continue the review of communications. And I think next we'll review a tape done on Admiral McKay.
With Rear Admiral Donald E. McKay. That's D-O-N-A-L-D, E as in Echo, McKay, capital M-C, capital K-A-Y, Rear Admiral, United States Coast Guard, retired. We are at his residence at 4309 Gregory Street, G-R-E-G-O-R-Y, in Oakland, California, 94619. Admiral Gregory's phone number is area code 415-531-2802.
And we are in the living room of his residence. And it is Wednesday, August 27th, and it's approximately 2:15 p.m. Pacific Standard Pacific Daylight Time. And Admiral McKay and I are in are alone here in his living room. If his wife is here, I don't know. What is your middle name? What does the E stand for?
Edward.
Edward. E-D-W-A-R-D?
E-D-W-A-R-D.
Okay, that's Don. Edward. When were you born?
January 7th, 1906, in Brainerd, Minnesota.
Brainerd.
Minnesota.
B-R-A-N-E-R-D. Brainerd.
Brainerd, Minnesota.
Well, that makes you... See.
I'll be 70 in January.
You're doing real well. Good.
Over the top.
Very good. I asked to interview you. Actually, I have four books. Well, this involves three books that I'm researching right now.
Go back to on this Line Island. I, in 1937... while I was in Honolulu as aide to Secretary Morgenthau, who was Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary was interested... Take it off. I was going to comment on Cedar Grove. Okay, get it. The Secretary was interested in the Amelia Earhart case. So he arranged to have a discussion with the commanding officer of the Itasca. As I say, in the back of my mind, I thought it was Captain Toll, but it could be Captain Gene Coffin.
Was this in 1937?
This was in 1937 in July or August.
Okay, this would have been Captain Warner K. Thompson.
I don't think so.
Yes.
Could be. Well, whoever was the skipper.
It was Warner K.
Warner K.
Thompson.
Yeah, I know W.K. Thompson. I knew his son also. The exec, of course, was Frank Kenner.
No, I'm sorry. The exec was Baker. Mr. Baker. But Mr. Kenner was on board. Mr. Kenner was on board as a...
Navigator?
No, he was just an extra crew member. He was sort of called a pilot, but he was just a... He was a supernumerary. He really wasn't part of the ship's company, except as a addition. But he was on board. But he had no official capacity except possibly as pilot. Which there isn't no such thing.
At what time? What year was this?
June and July of 1937.
Okay, well, your research and I'm dependent upon 40
years
of
memory. Well, that's all right.
Okay, but anyway, in the discussions, the captain was there, and Frank Kenner was there.
Very possible.
And I believe also the executive officer, if there was an executive officer different than Frank Kenner. But anyway, the logs were made available, the radio logs were made available at the time, and I remember vividly the skipper's description of the final communications with Amelia Earhart and her navigator, who was, I can't remember his name, but...
Noonan,
okay. They were sent down to the Line Islands to establish a radio direction finder station. They did not know at the time that the Amelia Earhart and her navigator had dumped their 500 kilocycle transmitter, mm-hmm, and left it behind they had, at that time, they had nothing but high-frequency, so-called, and the high-frequency direction finder was very limited in its usefulness in those days. But anyway, they communicated. They established communication with the Earhart plane. She was flying into the sun. They made smoke on the ship to try to make a signal. They, from the signal that came in on the radio, it seemed that she approached them and then left them. The signal became louder, and then it finally got less volume. And in the last minutes or seconds of the communication, she became hysterical on the radio. And it was the impression of the skipper and the people that listened in on the radio that they dove into the water at the last minute and it was all over. Now, I can go back further. I was assistant to the Chief of Communications in Washington at the same time I was aide to Secretary Morgenfeld. I was given the job to, as liaison, to try to work out the communication plan with the Earhart round-the-world flight. She was originally to take off from San Francisco to go to Honolulu. So we dealt at that time with the communication officer who has since died, but he was the communication officer in San Francisco for the Coast Guard.
Remember his name?
Frank something. I can't remember.
Okay.
I can find it. But he was a communication officer in San Francisco with, I believe, Captain Parker was the skipper of the 12th Coast Guard District here. I'm not sure. But I think he was Frank. I should remember the name, but I can't. But anyway, the arrangements were back and forth here, and we insisted, if we were going to have anything to do with communications, that she would have a 500 kilocycle transmitter, which works on the distress frequency. She aborted the trip out here. I don't know what the reason was, but they aborted the trip here and went back around the world the other way. And it was not until after they departed Miami, I believe they went out of Miami, but it was not until they departed the East Coast that we finally found out that she didn't have 500 kilocycle equipment aboard. And I, in my personal opinion, feel that that was what caused the loss of the plane. That if she'd had 500 kilocycle, it'd been no problem whatsoever to home. Now, there was in existence a confidential communication study made of the Earhart case. I had a copy up until about 8-10 years ago when I cleaned out some things. I dumped it as no longer pertinent. But there must be copies of that in Washington, D.C., in the Coast Guard headquarters. A confidential communication study made in 1937-38, which contained the radio logs of the ship and all the information pertinent to the trip. And I think it would settle any arguments that have been flying over the years about the Earhart case, if that's available. The only person I know of, and he'd have to depend the same as I do on 40 years of memory, would be Bob Finley up in Seattle, who probably, I don't think he's got a copy of it, but he is the one, I think, that made the study.
I'll interject there at that point. Bob, I've interviewed Bob Finley at length, and he didn't make the study, but he believed that a study was made. He said it was standard procedure in distress cases to make a communication study, and he definitely did believe that a communication study had been made at the Earhart case, and I went clean through Coast Guard and Washington and everything, and if there ever was a study made, a communication study made, it never could be found. I'll start the tape again.
Robert W. Finley.
I spell that last name.
F-I-N-L-E-Y. He's a lieutenant commander retired. He was a chief warrant officer at the time. And he lives at 1321 South Nevada Street, Seattle, Washington, 98108.
You don't have a phone number on him, do you?
I don't have his phone number. He is... I doubt that he has a copy of this because it was a confidential report. But, and he'd have to rely, the same as I do, on 40 years of memory. Maybe his memory's better than mine. But if you could get a copy of that from Washington...
I don't want to... I have a copy.
You have a copy of that confidential report?
Right here.
Well, you can solve all the arguments on the Earhart case with them.
I'm not sure it doesn't bring out more. yes, it's all there. I have the radio logs, and I have the part. Would you like to just kind of look at it and make sure I have what you mean? This is the one that was made by Commander Thompson in 1937 aboard the ship. And was probably turned over to the secretary when they got back, when you met him in Honolulu.
But do you don't have the one from headquarters put out by Washington, D.C., the Coast Guard headquarters?
No, I don't believe so.
It's about so thick.
No.
It has all the background information and everything.
Now, how would that be referred to? Now, this is from Commander Thompson. This is Commander Thompson's report that is dated the 19th of July, 1937, at sea. It was before they aboard the Itasca. He made this up coming back to Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Sutter? Sutter? Puffy Sutter? Puffy Sutter? William L. Sutter? W. L. Sutter?
Sutter?
Yeah.
Sutter. Bill Sutter.
He was communications officer on the Itasca.
He was a... Sutter.
W. L. Sutter. Bill Sutter. They called him Puffy. Sometimes they called him Stud.
Yeah, I think so. Well, he's retired, too.
Yes, he's retired.
Maybe he's dead. I don't know.
No, he's back in New York. He works for the Maritime Service. He runs a school for...
Retired as a commander?
Captain? Retired captain. Mm-hmm.
Captain. I thought he'd died.
No, he's still alive.
I know him.
But you're speaking of another report, then, besides this report.
Oh, yes. Because, you see, that is strictly the ship's report.
Yes.
That was probably used, without doubt, that was used to compile the report that Washington put out. But Washington's report covers all the background from the beginning on that trip.
I see. You believe that Commander Finley...
Well...
might know something about it.
I doubt that his memory is any better than mine, and therefore you've got probably more information than that, although he worked on it and he might be able to do it.
But what would that report have been called?
It was called a communication study. The communication study, and they were numbered 1, 2, 3, so and so. Communication studies, they were put out on specific disasters and things.
I see.
And if it was one that we didn't want in the newspapers for one reason or another, it was classified confidential.
Understandable.
In other words, there were remarks made in this that might have been misinterpreted by newspapers as a reflection on Miss Earhart or her husband Putnam or Noonan. In other words, it was the conclusions drawn and so on. And therefore, it was classified, I'm sure, as confidential. But, of course, today it's declassified.
Now. Yeah.
But there must be a file of communication studies. Until I discontinued those must be in the file somewhere.
Well, the National Archives or the Naval Institute or the Coast Guard historian should be able to help me then.
I would say so.
Okay.
I would say so. And it would be a communication study that was put out. Now, there was one made on the Morro Castle and things like that. And there was one, this would be dated sometime...
38?
Probably, it would be after that. It would be sometime late in 57 or early 58.
37 or 38.
I mean, 37
yeah, that's
or
right.
38.
Historian about this, and he made a search for me, and he told me that it was not in existence, and he said that he would deny it if I ever brought it up, but that the communication study of the Amelia Earhart distress case had been removed and destroyed and was forever gone. And I was wasting my time looking for it. I would never find it. It would be kind of interesting to go back to the files and see if you could find these distress cases, like Admiral McKay said, they were numbered, and see if there's a number missing. That might be interesting. I just might give that another go next time I'm in Washington.
It'll be late.
Okay, I'll look that up.
Because... all of it was gone together, and then it was all put down in a chronological sequence, the whole thing. Now, it included intercepts that other stations made, too. As I say, unfortunately, I had a copy and threw it away some years back. I searched for it one time when something was written about Amelia Earhart, and I wanted to... Refute the thing, but I couldn't depend upon my memory.
All right, I'll find that. If it exists,
but
I'll find it.
You've got something. Where'd you get that from? Headquarters?
I got this from the National Archives.
National Archives. Well, if they've got that, they must have the other.
This was forwarded to headquarters.
That's Dobler.
That's Dobler. He forwarded this to headquarters. Because it was turned in to San Francisco, to the 12th District. Dobler forwarded to headquarters for their information.
Well, he must have been communication officer in
San Francisco.
Well, he...
But he came in later. See, look at this date. This is...
Yeah, the Frank, whoever it was, preceded him.
Right, right.
By the way, that's Frank Johnson.
Dobler was on the Itasca up to about 2 or 3 months before the trip.
I was going to say, I thought that he was on the Itasca. That's why I thought he could give you more of the dope on the Line Islands.
He did. He gave me a lot of information on the Line Islands.
Now, my only information on the Line Islands was this, during this talk with Thompson. Funny, I can't place, I was thinking it was either Toll or Coffin, but they were all contemporaries.
No, they were different
but
times.
Thompson, there was a discussion at that time about the work that was going on in this colonization of the Line Islands. Then I had nothing more to do with the Line Islands until 1956. I attended a reunion of the Line Island Boys.
That's the end of side one, tape number 9. We'll turn over now and continue the interview on side 2.